This week's Black Law Travel Edition takes you to the heart of the conversation at the Yabun Festival. We're in the speakout tent for a crucial panel on sovereignty, where speakers tackle the realities of living sovereignty and decolonization, alongside a look at legal representation models for tribal governance.
Pazuri Gamarua. G'day in the local language. My name's Nathan Moran. I'll be facilitating today. Today we've got a gathering of deadly voices speaking about deadly topics. Apologies for the late start, but we're going to get underway now. We're going to talk about sovereignty first, about a core issue in our communities that remains. I want to acknowledge all the panellists today. We'll have up to an hour together. Each panellist will get a chance to introduce themselves, a bit about their background, actions that they're doing in the area of sovereignty, and then at the end we'll have a Q&A. So just be patient with us, we'll get through to the end and then we'll get a chance to ask questions and answers. But I'll kick off with Uncle Joe and we'll get through today. Thank you.
You should be live now. Yeah, my name is Lompa Jumbajimba, David Cole. I'm born and bred in Darwin, descend from the Prudham and Wanpanpa tribes in Central Desert, and I'll let my uncle introduce himself.
Hello, Sydney. I am from Alice Spring, you know, west of Alice Spring is there's the place called Kintore, near WF Water. But I'm willing to see you, Sydney community and city people. Yes, I'm willing to see you, Marv.
Wurrumbuli, my name is Gurig or Gurijala. I'm from Wadanungu in central Queensland. Been living out in the bush on a coal mine, on the northern section of a coal mine for about 1,614 days today, out in the middle. The closest town... Thank you. The closest town is about three hours' drive away, so the luxuries of life are a little bit further away than what most people are used to. And so I got out of the bush. Luckily, I got out of the floodwaters to be able to get here today. And shout out to all the Gadigal elders, past, present. Thanks for inviting us here today. I'll pass you on.
Gaiwara Galanyundu, may God's peace be upon you. In the almighty name of Yeshua, Jesus. I'm Murumu. Saint Murumu is my title. I'm not perfect, but I put saint in there because I believe we are sons and daughters of the Most High, and we are created in His image. And when we talk about sovereignty, there's two sides of it. There's the spiritual side of sovereignty, and then there's the administrative side of sovereignty. I talk mainly about administrative side, but I can talk about spiritual law as well. And I'm also the Minister for Foreign Affairs and Trade for the Yidinji government. I also hold office for the Minister for Financial Technology, Minister for Communications and Broadband and Renewable Energy. And I'll be talking mainly about our office and our government and how it works.
All right. So you're here today from a range of speakers, one missing in the chair, just to explain. Chelsea Wadigo, Professor, she'll be joining us later throughout the panel, and if not, we'll have her this evening. But first of all, we might try and talk a bit more about what's happening at home with yourself in regards to sovereignty, what's going on up there, what actions you can share with us, and then any learnings you can share with us.
We're a part of the Pindabi Wadi Judah Jungarinji, which is our senior law council. My Uncle Joe here is our senior law holder for that council and our senior cultural leader. He's a very special man. He's not just a treasure to this country, he's a treasure to humanity. And our council is made up of between 15 to 20 senior elders, just like Joe, that are not only our knowledge holders, but they are our leaders. I'm an ambassador for our Wadi Council, but I'm led by great wisdom like this great man sitting next to me. So everything we do with our council is driven by our elders' council, and that also includes the women. So the women have their council, and our men and our women, they communicate together to make decisions on what we're doing as a nation with our Wadi Council. So we've formulated our council over the last 5-6 years and we're now in the process of, we're doing a bit of catch-up. Yidinji's done some amazing work around their governance. We've been tying it up at the cultural end, and now we're stepping into that process of establishing good governance to be able to self-govern our own affairs and move forward and make decisions that are in the best interest of the nation. So it's a very slow process because we have a lot of elders across a landmass the size of Germany that we've got to traverse just to get decisions made. So if we have to go and have a conversation with several elders, we've got about a 3,000-kilometre round trip just on his country to be able to traverse to get decisions made. So nothing's done, nothing's rushed. Everything's done carefully. But we're in a stage where now we're starting to reach out to other tribal groups and we're starting to establish our tribe-to-tribe treaties. Those treaties already exist. They exist from ancient millennia time under our jukurba, under our law. So every tribe across this country is already connected under our law from the beginning of time. We're just formulating that in the new time so people can see our friendships, our relationships that we're forming, and we're slowly reaching out and formulating treaties, not just with tribes here, but we're formulating treaties with tribes across the country as the planet as well. So we've done a treaty with the Philippines. 110 bloodline tribes in the Philippines have signed a treaty with the Pindabi in the middle of Australia. So we are reaching out not only to tribes here but around the world, because it's time that we bring Mother Earth back into balance. It's time that we look after the water, the air, the land. And when we look at the ancient knowledges of the planet, all ancient knowledges, including the ancient tribes in Europe, they were all looking after Mother Earth once. So we are working together to unite the tribes here and across the planet to come back to taking care of Mother Earth, because that's our responsibility for the children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. We have to make sure we leave a healthy planet. So our focus is getting it right in the desert, reaching out, working together, and we're really excited because our council is the highest level of authority that you can hold on this land. And we have a very, very strong council that's making really, really positive decisions. And just like my uncle here taught me, in our law, we must all rise up or all stay down. Not one up and the rest stay down. We must work together to bring everybody up, and that's the law. So we're not only doing that with the Pindabi tribe, but we're working really, really hard to share what we're doing and to learn. I learn from my brother here, my two brothers. We learn from each other all the time. We learn from what each other's doing, and we share knowledge, we share information, and we're just trying to step into the strongest space we can to take our self-determination, because, quite frankly, if we don't, we're going to lose it all, and we're losing it rapidly. So time's against us, and we're working as hard as we can. There is no resources. Everything we do, it's all out of love and passion for our culture, for our people, for the land, and for the children. So we're just powering along with Pindabi, and we're working with all the other tribes, and we look forward to reaching out to the Australian people in the near future and asking you to walk with us as well, because the reality is we can't do it without you and you can't do it without us. And if we're going to create a healthy future, it's going to require unity. My father was Mr. Guruwiwi, the Yidaki master from Northeast Arnhem Land. And before he passed, he gave me a very hard task, which was, he said, you need to unite all the tribes. And after you unite the tribes, you need to unite the tribes with the rest of Australia. And we need to take back our power, and we need to protect the water, the land, for the future generations. And that's a responsibility that we all hold. And I share that story with you because that responsibility is yours as well. You have children, grandchildren. They're our responsibility. What we leave them is our responsibility in this time. We're here for but a short time. So I'm very proud to bring Uncle Joe here, because he's not only our senior cultural leader, but he's a national treasure and a very special man. So bringing him here to introduce him to you is a pleasure. And I'll just check if Uncle wants to say anything, and then I'm going to pass it on to my bros. He'll talk after. But yeah, I'm going to hand you over to Cody.
Okay. That's funny, you know, because his adopted father, Guruwiwi, their sons adopted me and their brother as well, so we're brothers in the same family. And, you know, my quest when I first started going out to country, I did it in anger. I did it in anger because inside of me I've had injustices happen to my family by this government, and I felt like I needed to right those wrongs in any way possible that I could. And while sitting there, you know, I lit this fire out in the middle of the bush, and it's directly opposite this big coal pit and this massive big high wall directly opposite where I am with this fire. And I sat down and I lit this fire, and we had three rules. One is the fire always has to stay lit. Number two, there's no Miglu objects, no foreign objects inside the circle. And number three, we had to have one of our clan group in that circle at all times. Rain, hail or shine, we had one family member inside that circle on the top of the hill for 408 days. Rain, hail, shine. I sat through 200 mils of rain on the first 26th of January when we got there. And I thought to myself, what am I doing this for? Why am I sitting in the rain trying to sit next to a fire and make sure it doesn't go out? Because it quickly dawned on me that many Aboriginal people across this country are relying on that fire too, because it keeps them alive. It lets them know that out of all the destruction that's happening around us right now in this country, they can still see that somebody is still making a headwave, that somebody is still creating a path that isn't what the government told us what our path was. And so through that process, I begin to realize that I was starting to heal my trauma. And nearly every Aboriginal person that you talk to will have some traumatic experience of what happened to their family. And so every Aboriginal person is carrying around this trauma with them. And the one way that I was able to help fix that trauma was to go back to country and sit next to a fire. And I started to realize that anger inside of me just started to die down. And I started to understand compassion because I was there, and I started to begin to realize that I can't use violence to fight this government. Aboriginal people could never use violence to fight this government, because this government is made up of some of the most savage people that have ever walked this earth, that they have done to every single Indigenous people around the world what happens when you try to fight back with violence. So you fight back with compassion, and you fight back with resilience to say, I'm not going anywhere. I sat down here by this fire, and I'll continue to sit down here by this fire, because you can't stop me from sitting by my fire. We've seen it for ourselves in the Ten Embassy when the Ten Embassy first got up. How is that fire still running? It's the world's longest protest, because they set up and nobody can interrupt that Aboriginal person sitting next to a fire. And then through that process, I started to realize that, well, I'm not even just doing this for my family anymore. I'm doing this for the 27,000 hectares of land that is there, with untouched trees that have been there that still have my old people's placentas still in them. When we cut the tree, when the sunrise come up, we put it into the tree of where the sunrise come up, so we know when that child's birthday is. So we know a calendar of what exact day of the year it is from all the birthing trees that we have there. And so that's our right to come home and reconnect back into earth. And so we've got our nieces and nephews' placentas, and we put them back into the trees along with all the other trees. We've completed the circuit and come back around again and planted the seeds back into the ground for them to flourish, because that baby's essence goes down into the trees, down into the roots, and then we burn off, and then those little truffles grow from the roots, and then the little kangaroo rat comes along, picks up those truffles, takes that baby along everywhere, all around the area. Connects that baby back into country that was taken from us to be able to connect back into country. It's the most simplest ideology that you could ever have, because you get it from nature. The epiphanies that I have had from sitting in the bush has come from sitting in the bush. Not having TV, not having any of those distractions and just sitting there and contemplating, because there's a scientific name for this and it's called epigenetics. It means there's things written in my DNA that there's answers inside of me that I can only access when it gets into certain situations. And I feel like when I'm sitting by this fire, I have the ability to access back into this genetic information and what it is to be. And that's all it is, to be. And that's where sovereignty doesn't come from. There is no sovereign citizens. And there's not, don't get it twisted between Aboriginal sovereignty and sovereign citizens. They're two separate things. Sovereign citizens are police killing right-wing extremists. And then you have sovereignty. But for me, my idea of sovereignty is the water. The water is the ultimate creator, because everything is made of water. Everything is made of water. If we know that it's the creator, because there's one thing that we can't make. We can make anything on this earth, but we can't make water. We know how it's made. We can't smash two bits of hydrogen and oxygen together to make the water. So we know it's our creator. We're all got it in us at the same time. It's all omnipresent. You drink water out of the river, you're part of the Balbara Bajirana, the river dreaming. How you, everyone who has ever lived in this whole world has all lived next to a river. And you've drank from that river. And then you've gone to the toilet and those molecules of you have come out and they go into the river and they go down into the ocean, back up into the clouds, back down to the mountains, back down into the rivers again. That's the Balbara Bajirana, the river dreaming. And it keeps happening and keeps happening over and over again. And that's how every human around the world is all connected. And I come up with that sitting in the bush. And so that's what the ability that Indigenous people need, that ability to go back to the bush, to be able to heal by going, well, if I can heal, then I can then teach other people how to heal as well. And it doesn't come from me just sitting in front of a therapist and trying to figure out what my life is, when I know the realizing that this concrete scrub here is not the life that I'm supposed to live. That the life I'm supposed to live is out on country protecting my totemic animals, my Gurijala, the wedge-tail eagles, protecting the Gundulu, the emu, the law. And so these things are more important than me, than having a career. And these things are being lost at a massive rate for many Aboriginal people across the country. And, you know, you can't heal if you can't heal. You can't expect someone then to heal as well if they don't have the ability to heal. And if they don't know how to heal themselves because they can't get back out on country, then are they ever going to really heal? So we've got a whole bunch of traumatized people that have been traumatized that haven't got the ability to just be. And so being out on country, that's what it's dawned on me. And what's dawned on me is country is number one important out of everything. And if that's not savored and protected now, then in the next seven generations, they're going to blame me that I didn't stand up and do something about it. At least I can say to the generations ahead that at least I stood up and at least I gave it 100% and I dedicated 100% of my life to fighting for something for everybody else's future generation. Even if they don't care, one day their grandchildren will thank us for standing up and stopping this government from stealing everything and destroying every river, because they're in the processes of it right now. You know, 85% of Queensland is cleared for beef. All of that poison from all the E. coli from the things are going into the rivers, and our rivers are being destroyed at an alarming rate, that someone needs to stand up and go, sorry, we're not going to let you do this anymore, because you might not have a responsibility to the future generations, but we got a responsibility to the future generations. You know, I don't have a word for it in my language, but Yulungu call it Jungaya, custodian. and they're custodian. If you're a custodian of somewhere, then they have the responsibility. Like, we're the custodians of Dungmubula Springs. That spring's been running since the dawn of time. And it's sacred. And sacred water is water that hasn't been a part of the Bulbara Bidjit and the River Dreaming. It's the stuff that comes straight out of the ground. No human molecules in it. That's why it's sacred. Because no human has ever touched it. And when you drink it, it's the first human that's ever drank that water. And that's what we have out there. We have ancient water that's being pumped out of the Great Artesian Basin. And at the moment, it's being poisoned by the mining company. So I'm there at the moment to try and stop them from at least destroying the northern section. That's a lot of where the soaks are for the Great Artesian Basin. So it's a very ecologically important place too. It's the crossroads of the western, of the desert and of the east coast as well, right on the Great Dividing Range. And, you know, country brought me to that area. I call it the river. I follow the river and it just takes me in the stream. You know how they say go with the flow? That's literally what it is. And I've just been following that all along and been out there 1,614 days. And just to prove to myself, to prove to the government, and also to prove to everybody else. One, to prove to the right-wing extremists that try to tell me that I've been conquered. Because if I've been conquered, how could I last 1,600 days in the bush and not one court case has been launched against me because they have no concrete evidence of who owns the land. So they're like, well, I guess we'll just miss this one. So I haven't been conquered. And so, but it's also a thing to Aboriginal people that not everything is lost. You can still fight for your homelands and the protection of your totemic animals. Because what's the point in having a totem if you can't protect it? Why can't you protect its homelands? This is the whole thing, you know. It's not just about having the animal, it's protecting the animal's environment as well to make sure that animal, if you do come back, if you believe in reincarnation and I believe that I'm coming back as that animal, then I want to make that animal, I want to make that space nice for that animal. That's my intentions. Thank you.
Thank you, brother. Thank you very much. I use the Bible for a lot of things with that. And be still and know that I am God comes to mind when brother was having these memories or visions, whatever you want to call them. You've got a really good panel here in terms of like lawmen, culturemen. And in Yidinji, that's called Jarnala Nyidinji. That's the Council of Elders. That's above where I sit. And so I'm sort of like the black sheep of the panels usually because I'm more about office work. I'm office man, they culture law man, you know what I mean? So I'm more about Times New Roman font, 12 point, getting the business out there. The reason why I say that is because when Captain Cook came past, he came as an officer of the British Crown. So he was looking for a Yidinji office to walk into and get a seal and stamp and a visa and all that kind of stuff. So the sovereignty that's here, we already know the mobs and the territories and even some of the stories that are shared and whatnot. So we know the law is there, but is it codified? Is it in a way or in a format that the rest of the world can see? Because Resolution 1514, Australia agreed to decolonise. So it has to have its whatever it is, the remnants of a European beginning are removed from the country. But where did they decolonise? How did it decolonise? So my job is to go around and encourage people to consider how to set up an administrative government or council to facilitate and that mechanism and create that mechanism. So, for example, I don't have any Australian ID because the only ID is the Yidinji one, which is created subject to our constitution and our law, and that's it. I jump on a plane with that. I've spoken at the World Economic Forums, a couple of them, with this ID, and I tell them what we're doing. I tell the whole world what we're doing. So it doesn't matter if it's where for the mob down the road, or this is what we do, and this is our office, this is our law. Today's a wonderful day to celebrate. January 26 is really important. You know, I know people have differing opinions, but for us, it's our Yidinji National Banking Day. And 4 years ago, we launched the first ever Indigenous Central Bank Digital Currency and Digital ID. We beat Russia, we beat China, we beat America, we beat Australia, we beat everyone to it. And we are making really good inroads to developing a digital nation where sovereignty can be invisible but allow our people to and others to administrate their territory without too much changing everything. I think people are a little bit frightened from sovereignty, and when they hear about the sovereign citizen movement, those guys are crazy. They're a threat to us and they're a threat to the Commonwealth of Australia. They want to be outside of the law, outlaws. So if they're not under Australian law or under Yidinji law, then we're saying, well, whose law are you on? Which mob are you from? Oh, we're under Magna Carta, this, sorry. That goes, go back to where that came from. So I think that's really important. One, we have our own stamps that we send to the international community. I've Zoomed with a president who got kidnapped the other week, a few years ago now, but we have international relationships with a number of UN member states. So it's because Australia signed UNDRIP, which is the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, they put their signature to it saying that Indigenous peoples have a right to self-determination, self-government, whatever it may be, and they have a right to participate inside of Australia if they so choose. But we don't choose to do that up there. But that doesn't mean everyone doesn't participate in Australia. But someone has to sit in that office, and unfortunately it's me, helping create the Yidinji paperwork, the Yidinji office, the Yidinji stamps, the Yidinji legislation, the public notices that go out to the rest of the world. So I think that's where we encourage people to look at the law and how you can use that and codify it to let the international community know who you are, how you operate, and basically it's not too crazy from the written stuff. So most people in Australia, on our territory, can become Yidinji citizens. It costs nothing. And, you know, there's, I think we have 300 Yidinji citizens, and we're building it stronger and stronger. So, I mean, that's where I can sort of talk about those things. But these other ones are really important because there is that long-standing connection to country where Australia has absolutely no doctrine for claims of sovereignty. We know that even the lawyers and the judiciary are. You know, in the opening of the law ceremony in Cairns, Gimoy we call it, the Supreme Court has our national flag flying up there by itself. No Australian flags on that pole. It's right in the middle because we grant them permission to open up that court. So it's very important. One thing to, which I say, you know, we know that we own the land, but acting like we own the land is a new game for us to get involved with. We've been doing it for about 11 years or more now, and every day is exciting, every year is exciting for us because we're pushing it further and further and further. So I'm happy to answer questions or keep talking about that during the panel. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, panel. Thank you so much for sharing your journeys, experiences. More importantly, to share with you as a public about what's going on. Localised actions, activities for sovereignty, be it from what we know today as the NT or Queensland. I want to acknowledge but now myself. I do have a day job. I very much, like Murrumbu, have to do paperwork. I'm the CEO of the Local Aboriginal Land Council here in Sydney. It's known as Metro Local Aboriginal Land Council. But I'm a Biripi and Thungudi. The last, my Thungudi heritage, to acknowledge we're the first native title holders of Australia. We were forced in 1996, after the passing of the legislation, thanks to Eddie Mabo and the great fight that he won, and acknowledge the great man who just passed recently from this area, a Wiradjuri man, Mr. Paul Coe. Uncle Paul was our first to put a sovereignty case in New South Wales as a nation. He led Wiradjuri in 1977. The land council that I work for, he helped establish. Indeed, the same year he moved that case, he was part of establishing land rights. We were part of seeking out a national movement for all of our people. That goes back to 1938. And acknowledge that today, on the 26th of January, thereabouts at 5 p.m. in 1938, our mob led, held the first all-Aboriginal conference. It's also known as the first human rights protest. We put out a 10-point plan. That plan's still relevant today. For those who aren't aware, I'd suggest please have a look at what we set out in 1938 about trying to seek out rights for our people.
Prior to that, this area is very rich, acknowledging where we're on Gadigal country and the surrounding clans, be they Bidjigal to the south, over the north, the Gamaragal or the Wongal to the west, and the Ganagal to the far east. This is an area of resistance. We go back and we acknowledge Arabanu, our first kidnapped fella from this lands, who died in custody. They named the town of Manly after him. But that's the realities of our contact. Certainly want to acknowledge who's buried beside him is Barangaroo and the resistance of our females. For those who aren't aware, Barangaroo was the leader, of course, of the Gamaragal, the North Shore people. She's more known for choosing a husband. That husband got a bit more famous than her. But her actions, her leadership as a female, as a leader, is forever more paramount in what we acknowledge today as our fight for sovereignty. She was asked to meet the governor with her then husband, Bennelong. She did. She dressed appropriately. She drew, of course, on her culture. Unlike her husband, who wore the regalia of the colony, she wore traditional body art. She walked into the governor's colony to have that first sit down. We've been representing that respectful acknowledgement of who we are from day one. And I just hope people have got a bit more appreciation of our battle for sovereignty, for rights and respect. From first contact beyond, many more of you, I'm sure, are aware of Pemaway. Barangaroo's offsider was Mosquito, a great warrior so great they sent him down to the Palawa people in Tasmania. He led them in resistance, so they sent him to Victoria, to Koori country, to Kulin Nation. He was hung in Port Phillip. A great warrior of the Gamaragal, who what the colony called was a terrorist, who wouldn't allow him to rest, to occupy his lands. His cousin and kin, of course, is Pemaway in the south, from the Bidjigal. This is an area ripe with resistance and fighting for sovereignty. The last point is recorded in 1836 in colonial records. A local fellow of the Eora known Bummery or Boomery. He told the court, "I do not answer to you, I answer to my law." So we've got a long history in standing up for our rights, be it right up to most recently what you're hearing now or since contact. And I hope that throughout today and maybe even later today, you'll get a chance to hear some more. We're going to throw the questions and answers to the floor now for any of you who'd like to ask. I think we've got about 10 spare, so just be mindful. Of questions, please be respectful, but we will open it up for questions and answers now. You all right, you fellas? Let's do it. Anyone like to kick us off? Any standouts, fast hands, I'll do my best to try and capture you. See if my eyes have got it. Any fast hands? No questions? One, got your brother in red. Just bear with me. I'll walk it over to you, brother.
I'm just interested to hear more about the treaties amongst other Indigenous groups and clans and internationally and how that's going and what's the maybe the long-term benefit, the plan, and how's it going to change things? Because to me it sounds instinctively right, and I want to support it and I want to understand and hear more about it.
The short answer is two-thirds of the planet was invaded by the Spanish and the English. That's two-thirds of the planet of Indigenous nations. We've put out our treaty to all tribal nations of the planet. We have 53 bloodline African kingdoms that are looking at signing it. We have just signed a treaty last week with the American Indian nations. And we're all going to meet in March somewhere on the planet. And we're all coming together to have a discussion about our self-determination, working together. And when two-thirds of the planet are bringing the protection of Mother Earth back under Indigenous knowledge, then we have hope for our future generations. So that's the intention, that's the hope. We've not planned any of this, it's just happened organically. And at some point we have to remember that under the international laws of maxim in law, it's first in time, right at law. So the first law of a land cannot be superseded by any new law. And the English knew that when they came here. That's why Resolution 26-25-25 was passed in October 1969 at the United Nations, adopted in 1971, which required a speedy decolonization of the entire planet. And that's why Australia was supposed to hand it back in 73. That's why the Crown left here in 73. Right? All they left behind was an administration body that was supposed to do the right thing. They haven't. They registered it as a corporation. They've been running as a corporation under the US government ever since, and we have been under that occupation. So we are not a sovereign nation. The tribal people are sovereign people. Everyone else here, we're homeless. So we have a chance here to unite. We have 27 million plus on this continent, and we have a chance to come together to stand under the true law of this land, because if we continue under this corporation that's impersonating a government, everyone else is slowly finding out what we've been crying out for 234 years, because the genocide hasn't stopped. My grandmother, I got light skin because I was a part of the White Australia policy. They stole my grandmother in order to take the colour out of me. What they didn't count on was the spirit and the blood staying black. Okay, I'm rooted in my culture. I'm rooted in the ground. Our children are being stolen at a higher rate now than the stolen generation years. Right now, we are 85% of the child protection numbers and we're 3% of the population. Nationally, we're around 28% of the prison population and we're 3% of the national population. Every statistic that we represent is in the high 80s to 100 for everything. In the territory, we are 95% of the adult prison population. We're 100% of the juvenile prison population, but we're only 36% of the population. So it's either that we're intrinsically criminals or we have a racist system that's making sure that we end up in jail, our children get taken, and we're being genocided right before Australia's eyes. So we have to stop dodging the truth. If we're going to have reconciliation, it can't be in colourful hands in the ground. It's got to be in yous walking with us to allow for us to self-determine what's best for us. Because we can look after our children. We can look after our people. We're never given the right or the ability. When you have a $35 billion industry and less than a billion's hitting the cold front, and out of that billion, governments, NGOs, private enterprises are taking all that resource, I can assure you, out of the $38 billion that they spruce to you that they give to tribal people, I can assure you that less than 5% of that's hitting the ground. And I ran a suicide prevention program for 20 years and we never ever got more than 5% of what we needed to keep our children alive. And when we expose child abuse in the system, they cut our program. So we're up against a system that doesn't want to see tribal people take their rightful place. Joe Bjorke Peterson said this, "Be very careful allowing the Aboriginals to rise up because they'll become the next Arab." And the second Prime Minister of Australia said, "Be very careful stealing these children because the light-skinned blackfellow will be the one who comes back to reclaim their land." Well, that time's arrived. The knowledge is there. We can't live in ignorance anymore, no matter who you are, where you're from. It's time to reconcile with yourselves. It's time to reconcile with the truth. And it's time to stand with the truth and allow for the tribal people of this land to take back our autonomy, our self-determination, and fix what's been caused from 274 years of well-entrenched genocide.
Anyone want to speak further to that one? We'll wait for another one.
Yep. I think the treaties are really important. Once again, those tribal agreements and treaties between lawmen and peers or members of a society are above the government that I'm talking about today. However, once the peerage or the members of a society form a council or their governance structure, that's where the Yidinji government, for example, puts that and codifies those treaties for the international community to see. Because otherwise, sometimes it's a message stick, or there's other ceremonial things that happen at that top level, the same way that Charles and everyone would do similar things with the royals in Europe. I think the other important thing too is that when you have a government, you start to not worry about. You can start your treasury, you can start your own Bills of Exchange Act, your Finance Act, and all these things, the Reserve Bank Act. And start to actually create that law that allows you to do that in your world. And that's where those treaties are really important from whether it's a police powers sharing agreement with these guys when if they have police or whatnot, or what's the value of their dollar with the Yidinji dollar, the SID, the sovereign Yidinji dollar, for example. That's where we're coming in from that level. And how do you harmonise that? How does, you know, one of brother's sisters married a Yidinji man, and what happens to the dispute resolution with the custodianship over the children? What laws that come under, or is it coming under some sort of mediation process that's government-based, for example? So the letter of the law is really important in some places, and that's where we're encouraging that. And the Bible's really good because it's case law. One of the great things is, Moses writes to the people of Israel, if you're going to appoint a king over you, make sure he's not a foreigner. So is Charles one of your mob? He's not Yidinji. So we're saying we can't have a king over us that's not from us. So, sorry, using the book that you've got in every courtroom, we're saying if that's the law, then I'm sorry, Charles, you can't be king for Yidinji. So it's really using that case law, and even Israel's journey to sovereignty, whatever you think about Israel, I support their sovereignty. But, you know, when you look at what we're doing and maybe the state of Israel and how they're doing things, ours is very different. We don't even have... Our police don't even carry weapons or firearms. It's just the truth. And that's a beautiful thing. That's the greatest thing that we've got. We don't need to be a light that we have every right to self-defense and all those things, but we know the price of peace on this continent. And, and sitting around a campfire and give a good yarn and sharing and all that stuff. And that's why Australia is relatively, I think, the violence is from a colonial past, because everything else was strong. The law was strong here. It was harmonious. Dispute resolution was dealt with very, very quickly. You're either isolated or even killed for doing stupid stuff. And unfortunately, lawlessness has been allowed to manifest, and it's now time for the tribes to actually take control of that. And having the culture and the law is there. It's already, because the sovereignty has never been ceded. It's the administration of that and how you express that to the rest of the world to say, we are now ready to administrate our territory, and Australia and everyone else has agreed to bring a speedy end to any manifestation of colonisation, and we're ready for that. However, what we're saying is we protect the Commonwealth of Australia so all of you guys can enjoy what is here on our territory, up there that is, so it's not too foreign and it's not like a hostile takeover or some sort of power vacuum where things can go nasty and wrong around the other parts of the world. You see that decolonisation transfer, there's a lot of stuff going on around the world even now as a result of that. So we're trying to do it in a way we're showing the international community, one through peaceful means and using the letter of the law and the sovereignty that is amongst the peers here and all the other mobs that are represented here today.
I just wanted to finish on a quick story. You mentioned Charles. So our father, Mr. Goodawiwi, his father went to England when Elizabeth was 23 or something, and they had a private meeting in a private room. And when royalty meets anybody, they leave on their gloves if you're lesser. They take off one glove if you're equal. They remove both gloves if you're superior. When she met with Munyu, she took off both her gloves in a private meeting, and she gifted him a sword. And when she gifted him the sword, she said, unite your people and take it all back. It's all yours. So Charles came out here during the Commonwealth Games and flew to Nhulunbuy to sit with my father to get a healing, a Yidaki healing from him. And during that ceremony, he asked my father, Mr. Goodawiwi, for forgiveness. And my father said, no, you will not be forgiven until you right the wrongs. And he didn't give him a Yidaki healing. He didn't heal him. He reset him. And he made it very clear. I reset him and I didn't forgive him until they fixed the wrongs. Now, we are extending a treaty, not to the corporate government. We're extending a treaty to the Australian people, because if we don't work together, we're all in a bad place. So this is not just about unity for the tribes. It's about unity for us as human beings, because this is a long slug. We're up against a corporate beast that doesn't have the best interests of any of us. So we're not just reaching out to our tribal brothers. We're reaching out to all our tribal brothers of every race, of every culture, and our treaty is extended to use the people, not to the corporate government. And we want to look after the people. And together we want to create something strong under our law, because the way we've set up our governance is we've set it up under our ancient law. And as you come down the chain, then we move into more the Westminster structure of getting jobs done, building roads, putting a pole in or whatever. But at the top, we are governed by our ancient law. And when you're governed under that ancient law, there is no room for corruption, fraud, treason or nepotism. So the Wadi Council, the Pindaby Wadi Council, we are strictly operating under our law only, and that's why we're progressing in a positive way and getting things set up across the entire nation, and we have the support of 100% of our tribal members.
Oh, yeah, no, look, just about the treaties and stuff like that, you know, like I think treaties amongst tribes and stuff like that is really all just formal recognition and stuff like that. At this point in time, Wadanungu won't be asking for any treaties with the Australian government, only because the treaty entails terms and conditions. And at this point in time, leaving it in a legal conundrum is almost better than having a treaty, because if they're never coming to take it, then they're never going to take it. So I guess I'm happy to stay in that legal conundrum than having an actual formal treaty that, you know, can be used against me or something later on in life, or what we see in the Maori people at the moment in Aotearoa having to still defend the treaty after, you know, 150 years or so. So, you know, yeah.
Thank you. I was just thinking about your statement about corruption, and of course, corruption for Aboriginal people is probably our number one enemy. It's a very evil entity, people. What happens behind closed doors, big deals are made, and we've kind of been the butt of that since day dot. In relation to sovereignty and our emerging sovereign processes, but also our long-standing sovereign existence, essentially on a cellular level with a cellular relationship with the soil and the environment for 80,000 years. Where do we stand on corruption in our own organisations? And what might we be able to do under our developing sovereign existence through an emerging sort of government process? What can we do? Is that something that we as a people are wanting to deal with?
No worries. Absolutely. We have to deal with it, and if we don't, we're going to fall over like everything else, right? Because corruption is the root of all evil. It just eats at everything from the inside out. That's why we stand with our Wadi Council under our law. You can't be corrupt under our law. Everything's in the middle, and everybody can see you. If you step out of line under our law, you will be seen, and you will be called out, and you will be punished. So the only way we can avoid corruption was never a part of our society. Neither was child abuse or anything like that. All of those illnesses were introduced to us by those who came here. So we have to step away from the corrupt systems that they've indoctrinated us into, and most of our corporations are. I'm not going to dodge it, okay? There is corruption at every level. Doesn't matter if it's black, white, or whoever is doing it. It is there. And once you step into the government's part, between that and our organisations, it's always corrupt, right? Because the system's just rotten. I mean, if it wasn't, we'd be healthy, all of us. So we're standing under our law to clean out the corruption, and there's just no room for it. That's what our council's doing.
Yeah, look, I think it just all really comes down to greed, you know, greed of not participating in a functioning community as you should, you know, because in a functioning community and running well, there shouldn't be those greedy people that are, you know, whether it's nepotism or whatever it is, you know, it really comes down to greed and how you address that as a group, you know, in having the standards on what your group says, okay, this, we're not going to deal with this type of stuff, you know. And I feel like it's a learned, like Lumpa was saying, it's a learned trait. You know, you learn to be greedy as a child, you know. So it's kind of like addressing those situations to kind of like mitigate those problems right from the start to try and to weed out those type of people.
Yeah, it's a great question because, you know, we look at that all the time in terms of why are we creating something like a government when there's a danger of just reproducing what's happening already, right? So this is a very good question. So we look at proceeds of crime, acts, legislation, anti-money laundering, financing terrorism, laws with our money, sovereign unity dollars, guilt-free money, by the way. There's no blood on our money. But, you know, for the love of money is the root of all evil. So even then, if Yidinji was fully functioning, there has to be some sort of mechanism to stop that from happening. So, for example, with the collapse of Soviet Russia, they changed the name from the USSR to the Commonwealth of Independent States, I think it was. Then now it's the Russian Federation. So the same way that happens, the elders and the tribal council can say, no, we're going to destroy that. We're going to create a new one now because the trust is broken. There's too much going this way and it's not working for us, which is what Australia is sort of operating like, right? You know, not that I'm an Australian. I don't want to speak out of school here, but all I'm saying is you can see those issues and they're very important. So I think keeping it simple and transparent, our government's pretty good like that, but doesn't mean it's going to be, you know, if it's man-made law, then man going to benefit too. Like, you know, brown paper bag here, brother, here's some kangaroo or dugong, whatever. So that can happen, but to have those things in place to limit that or the risk of that happening is very important. But that's where we come from. It, like, we know how much is in our treasury. We've got $10 million out there because we have a treasury note with $10 million sovereign unity dollars on there, right? So we know that that's all there is at the moment. I can't create a new batch and put it on the, because it's on the blockchain and everyone can see it in the future. So if people are hiding things or they're concealing stuff, the Great Spirit has a good way of exposing people when they're lying and doing all that stuff. So, yeah.
I want to acknowledge this panel, you mob. The deadliest yarn of the day. Sovereignty is the last discussion for the day.
And that's our wrap-up coverage from the Yaban Festival. Powerful words there on decolonization and the path forward for tribal governance. We'll be back with a regular episode next week. Until then, stay safe and thanks for listening to Black Law Tribal Edition.